Now, having looked at the loop, now what we've got to do is get to the distal convoluted tubule, and we'll look at the next figure, which shows us where the target is for the thiazide diuretics. This is a sodium chloride cotransporter. It doesn't involve potassium reabsorption at this site. And under normal circumstances, we bring in perhaps 10% of our sodium at this level of the tubule. The sodium, as it's brought in, would be exchanged for potassium by the pump once again, and the potassium diffuses back into the blood down its concentration gradient. The chloride also does that. When it's brought in, it diffuses across the basal lateral membrane in this fashion. Now, what I want you to see here is there is also, at this level of the tubule, ion channels for calcium, which are influenced by parathyroid hormone in terms of the synthesis of those components. Calcium runs down its concentration gradient into the cell through these channels and then is exchanged for sodium on the basal lateral membrane. Now, that's the normal situation, so this is certainly part of the, part of the tubule that will reabsorb calcium. Now, under normal circumstances, one sees that the sodium that's being brought in would actually be capable of modulating the calcium-sodium exchange mechanism and therefore actually allow one to increase our reabsorption of calcium. If we are not bringing in sodium into the intracellular space, then the activity of this calcium-sodium exchange mechanism is stimulated. And that means then that the intracellular concentration of calcium declines. Whenever that declines, then that allows for a greater concentration of gradient for calcium to come into the cell. So lack of sodium within the cell promotes the reabsorption of calcium by virtue of changing the activity of the sodium-calcium antiporter. And so instead of losing calcium in the presence of the diuretic, we gain calcium in the presence of this type of diuretic. This is completely opposite to loop diuretics. Loop diuretics prevent the reabsorption of calcium. Thiazide diuretics foster or stimulate the reabsorption of calcium. So it's very likely that the patient might become hypercalcemic because of that action. This is a very distinctive feature, as you would predict. Once again, by interfering with sodium absorption here, you're anticipated to give a load at the level of the collecting tubules such that you may get hypokalemia and alkalosis. So here's your mechanism stated. You inhibit the sodium chloride cotransporter at the level of the distal convoluted tubule. We've talked about the normal sodium exchange for potassium via the pump. Calcium diffuses across that membrane, the luminal membrane, regulated by parathyroid hormone, PTH, gets back into the blood by an antiporter. If you inhibit the cotransporter for sodium and chloride, you increase the luminal levels of those ions. This will ultimately lead to hypokalemia and alkalosis downstream. And we increase the activity of the calcium-sodium antiporter that facilitates the reabsorption of calcium, leading to hypercalcemia. So once again, if we were looking at urinary electrolyte levels, what would we anticipate seeing? We'd see an increase in sodium, increase in potassium because of the alkalosis, because of the effect of sodium downstream. We'd see an increase in chloride ions, but we should look for that decrease in the urinary levels of calcium. You can easily identify the difference between loop diuretics and thiazide diuretics by what happens to urinary calcium, and for that matter, what happens to blood calcium. Obviously, they go in opposite directions. So that's certainly a very key marker if you had to distinguish between the two types of drug. Now, there are lots of thiazides used clinically. Fortunately, in most examinations, they don't usually push you into a corner asking you which drug does which. But there must be a dozen or more different thiazides, and even more than that in combination with other drugs. The prototype thiazide is hydrochlorothiazide. I usually say to people, no, that one, and I also often add indapamide as another one, because it's got some distinctive properties. Like the loop diuretics, these compounds can be actively secreted across the tubule. So once again, they will be at high levels in the urine, and that would seem appropriate since they're going to act on a transport system that is on the luminal membrane. The use of these thiazides is very widespread in the treatment of hypertension and congestive heart failure. One of the beauties of them, as it were, is that they've been proven to have long-term efficacy in many situations that concern hypertension and in some situations for the congestive heart failure patient. They are used quite frequently in edematous states, sometimes in combination with loops. When used together, that's sometimes referred to as high ceiling diuresis. The edematous states associated with the pulmonary edema, nephrolithiasis. Nephrolithiasis, of course, is promoted by calcium in the urine. And if you decrease urinary concentration of calcium, then you decrease the likelihood of that type of renal stone. And the thiazides also have value in diabetes insipidus, where it's caused by resistance to antidiuretic hormone or caused by lithium-induced diabetes insipidus. Diabetes insipidus, you know, characterized by polydipsia, polyuria. The side effects of the thiazides, I think you should know a little bit here. Again, they're related to the sulfonamide family, and therefore it's not to be surprising, I suppose, that you will get some allergic reactions. I expect you to be able to easily identify that you're likely to get alkalosis and hypokalemia. I think the message is getting through there. Hypercalcemia as opposed to the hypocalcemia with the loop diuretics. And here's another interesting thing for us regarding management of patients who are hypertensive. Do you recall when we were discussing the value of beta blockers? We said beta blockers work in hypertension, and they do have long-term efficacy in terms of decreasing the consequences of atherosclerotic disease. However, many of them actually change blood lipid profiles in the wrong direction. They increase certain of the bad lipids, as it were. Well, the same thing goes for thiazides. They've been shown to have long-term efficacy in hypertension. They decrease morbidity and mortality, but rather surprisingly, they tend to increase low-density lipoprotein cholesterol and triglycerides when used in a chronic fashion. Not all of them do this, and as you can see, one of my reasons for identifying indapamide is shown here, because that does not appear to occur with indapamide, but the traditional thiazides seem to be capable of causing hyperlipidemias. Many of the thiazides, and I suppose that's true of many drugs used in hypertension, can have effects on sexual function, decreasing libido, for example. Now, the last part of the tubule that we need to discuss is the collecting duct and collecting tubules. Here we have two cells. We have a principal cell and we have an intercalated cell. The principal cell luminal membranes have channels for sodium. Now remember, we said that this part of the tubule is really like the final part of sodium reabsorption. Less than 4% of sodium normally comes in at this stage, running down its concentration gradient. The sodium ion channel components are under the control of the mineralocorticoid aldosterone via its receptor, which can, when activated, can increase the synthesis of the components of the sodium ion channel. Now, what happens under normal circumstances is that sodium coming into the cell is once again exchanged for potassium on the basolateral membrane by the pump, but there is also a change in terms of hydrogen ions and potassium ions at this level as sodium enters the cell. As sodium enters the cell, we see a loss of hydrogen and a loss of potassium ions. And in particular, the increased positive potential brought about by sodium in the cell actually drives potassium out. So here's your basis for the hypokalemia that might occur if you have a lot of sodium out here. Why would you have a lot of sodium out here? Because you interfered with its absorption upstream. So I think you could see what's going to happen here. As far as the intercalated cell is concerned, there's an energy-dependent proton pump that pushes hydrogen ions back into the lumen and actually controls our body pH, and also, of course, will be reflected in urinary pH at this stage. Carbonic anhydrase also plays a role here, although we don't generally think that the carbonic anhydrase inhibitors are having a striking effect at this level. They certainly can do that. So what happens when sodium comes in is that we lose a little bit of hydrogen ion here and certain amount of potassium ion here. Also, with sodium coming in, we increase the activity of this energy-driven proton pump, and so we lose some hydrogen ion there. Now, the extent of such loss depends on how much sodium is available in the luminal region to come in. And so, as I've said, if you've interfered with things upstream, more sodium comes in, therefore more hydrogen ion goes out, more potassium goes out, more activity of the energy-driven loss of protons. So, as I say, you're pretty much guaranteed to get hypokalemia and alkalosis with drugs that work upstream from the collecting tubule. What about drugs that work at the collecting tubule? Well, we have two types of drugs that work here. We have drugs that can actually plug this sodium ion channel, amiloride, triamterene are examples there. And we have drugs that can actually block aldosterone from stimulating the aldosterone receptor. And in both cases, of course, either by plugging the sodium channel itself or by interfering with the synthesis of the components of the sodium channel, sodium can't get in. So drugs that work at the level of the collecting tubule or collecting duct actually interfere with reabsorption of sodium by those mechanisms. Now, under normal circumstances, since less than 4% of sodium comes in there, you would anticipate that these drugs would not be very strong diuretics, because already 96% of your sodium is being reabsorbed earlier as far as the tubule is concerned. However, they do have a mild diuretic action in that regard. Perhaps more importantly, you should recognize that if you prevent sodium coming in here, then we do not lose as much of our hydrogen ions or our potassium. And that means that you tend to retain potassium. So instead of hypokalemia occurring, hyperkalemia may occur. And instead of losing protons, right, which leads to alkalosis, you will actually retain protons, which will lead to acidosis. So drugs that we think of as acting at collecting tubules, the so-called potassium-sparing agents, do the opposite to thiazides and loops in terms of potassium and in terms of hydrogen ions. And I think you can see by looking at the diagram how that comes about. We describe it now in words then. We've mentioned that the final sodium concentration in our urine and hence in our blood occurs by virtue of the action of the sodium ion channels in the collecting tubules. Normally this is controlled by aldosterone, and aldosterone stimulates the formation of the components of the ion channel. As sodium comes in, it changes the positive charge within the cell, and that tends to drive potassium back into the lumen. And as we said, sodium coming in increases the energy-dependent mechanism that extrudes hydrogen ions back into the lumen. That takes place in the intercalated cell. So when we're looking at the potassium-sparing agents, we've got either an aldosterone receptor blocker, spironolactone, or we've got the sodium channel blockers like amiloride. And in both cases, then, we're going to interfere with sodium reabsorption. Therefore, we're going to retain hydrogen ions. We're going to retain potassium. And therefore, what we're likely to see is an acidotic condition and hyperkalemia. And so if you were looking at urinary concentrations of things, I think we might anticipate a very small increase in urinary sodium, rather marked decreases in urinary potassium and hydrogen ion, leading to hyperkalemia and acidosis. Potassium-sparing agents then, I would identify spironolactone, amiloride, and triamterene in that regard. They're weak because, as I say, most of our sodium's already been reabsorbed. The uses of spironolactone are certainly very important in the area of hormonal pharmacology in conditions of excessive aldosterone. Preventing the action of the mineralocorticoid at its receptors would have a great deal of value. Sometimes we see spironolactone used along with other drugs in terms of their management of hypertension and congestive heart failure. You may recall that we said spironolactone used with ACE inhibitors actually increases survival rate in patients who suffer from congestive heart failure. Females who suffer from excessive hair growth, hirsutism, appear to have some value when they are administered spironolactone, which actually is not through its mineralocorticoid blocking action. It really just implies that spironolactone can also block androgen receptors. The uses of the sodium channel blockers are usually thought of as adjunctive to other diuretics, and the idea behind them is that since the other diuretics like loops and thiazides tend to cause loss of potassium, the use of a potassium-sparing agent should balance that. And it's important to remember, of course, that if a patient is already on a loop or a thiazide, they're probably taking supplementary potassium. And if they're then put on a potassium-sparing drug, they have to discontinue the potassium, otherwise they're at risk for hyperkalemia. We also use the potassium-sparing agents for lithium-induced diabetes insipidus, sidipidus. Amiloride is an example there. What can go wrong? Well, we said acidosis and hyperkalemia. That's certainly a possibility. The block of androgen receptors with spironolactone can lead to endocrine dysfunction, which includes gynecomastia, enlargement of the breasts, and also decreases in libido. And triamterene has been associated with nephrolithiasis. So if we look at the summary tables, we see that I've described for you in these tables the mode of action or the primary mechanism of action of each of the four primary classes of diuretic. I've shown you what might happen in terms of urinary electrolyte concentration and what happens in terms of blood chemistry that could be easily identified. And as we see, we can possibly identify a drug by name or identify a mechanism of action simply by looking at what's happening in the urine and sometimes by what's happening in the blood. So I thought if you saw it all together, this would be a very good summary for you. So on this particular slide, we have both the carbonic anhydrase inhibitor acetazolamide and our two examples of loop diuretics that I'd want you to know about. And then on the second part of the slide, we have the thiazides and the potassium-sparing agents. I suggest that you know the urinary electrolyte pattern, and as far as possible, of course, know the mechanisms of action.